Hi, my name is Taco. I want to say shout out to all the raccoons on campus. You're listening to CGSF 90.1 FM on Burnaby.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're going to try to understand what Iranian Canadians are going through right now.
What we should be aware of is that our prime minister just f***ed this up royally at the G7.
Wait for that.
We begin tonight with breaking news from the Middle East. Israel has launched a series of airstrikes on Iran's nuclear and military sites. It is a dramatic escalation in a long-running conflict between the two countries.
They targeted Iran's ability to attack and defend. They targeted key military leaders. And they targeted the country's nuclear program.
When Syria's President Bashar al-Assad was overthrown in December 2024, Israel took the opportunity to destroy any remaining threats to Israel's air force within Syria, effectively creating a safe corridor for future strikes on Iran.
Israel has done the world a favor. We're a safer place right now.
Friday evening, Carney posted Canada's position on social media, saying Iran's nuclear program has long been a cause of grave concern, and its missile attacks across Israel threaten regional peace. Canada reaffirms Israel's right to defend itself and to ensure its security. We call on all parties to exercise maximum restraint and move towards a diplomatic resolution.
While some Israeli leaders speak openly of regime change in Tehran.
So are you going to target the Supreme Leader?
We're doing what we need to do. More is on the way. The regime doesn't know what hit them. They don't know what will hit them.
A short time ago, the U.S. military carried out massive precision strikes on the three key nuclear facilities in the Iranian regime, Fordo, Natanz, and Esfahan. Tonight, I can report to the world that the strikes were a spectacular military success. Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been completely and totally obliterated.
There's a secret club in Canada. And trust me, you do not want to be a member. If you are in this club, your first response when you hear news about bombs and death and carnage in the Middle East, your first response is not to hop onto Twitter or Facebook to post your political opinion about it. No, your first response is to make a long-distance phone call to try to find out if your family and friends over there are still alive. Lebanese Canadians are in this club. Palestinian Canadians are in this club. Jewish Canadians are in this club. And last week, hundreds of thousands of Iranian Canadians joined this club too. They are now the largest group in this club. Like I said, I hope for you that you are not in this club. I hope nobody else has to join it. We don't want new members. Today I'm going to talk to two Iranian Canadians with very different perspectives about what has happened since Israel struck Iran last week. What it means, what it might mean. We're going to talk politics, yes, but we are also just going to talk about what they are going through, what their hopes and fears are, and how the rest of Canada, the Carney government, and the rest of us, their neighbors, how we can help. Wait for it.
I am Amir Antarin. I'm a law professor at the University of Ottawa.
Amir, my first question is, do you have any people in Iran who are in danger, who you're, you know, trying to check in with? Are your people accounted for and okay?
We don't know. Communications are pretty spotty right now. The internet is scarcely working in Iran. I have read, don't know, that even local phone calls aren't going through very often. As for using, you know, FaceTime or the usual ways that we stay in touch from Canada, that's just not working right now. I had a little taste of it last night because turns out that my cousin's wife, who was on a visit to Iran, is there. We can't reach her at the moment, and of course she can't come back.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. That's very stressful. I know a lot of Canadians with people in Israel and in Iran are going through this. This is going to be a difficult conversation. I can't imagine that when you're worried for people's well-being and struggling to get in touch with them, you're reflecting on the larger picture of things. I'm grateful for your time and your thoughts today. What is the mood beyond the obvious of stress and tension and worry? My understanding from our last conversation and from what I've read and what I've heard from Iranian Canadians is that there's like almost unilateral opposition to the regime. It must be complicated. How are people feeling about what's going on?
Well, I think you have a multitude of feelings at play at the same time. Sure, most of the Iranian community that is outside Iran, the diaspora, does not feel warmly towards the Islamic regime. Hardly care for that regime. I would very much like to see it gone, but that's not a sentiment I have unique to Iran. I'd like to see Donald Trump gone. I'd like to see Benjamin Netanyahu gone. And on top of that, you know, the feeling that they should go, there is a definite sense it is not Israel and America's job to make them go. And in fact, what Israel and the United States are doing gives rise to a different feeling, that of anger. Iran was on a more progressive turn lately. The new president, Pezeshkian, has been liberalizing. You don't get that easily in Iran. That was very hard won to see that in this tightly controlled political system, a more liberal-minded president was permitted by the religious authorities and the Revolutionary Guards to have power. You can pretty much count on that progress being reversed if there is going to be a larger or more enduring military intervention in Iran. The revanchist forces will gain the upper hand again. And, you know, what Iranians have struggled for, including by blood, to liberalize their daily lives, is now in peril. So no one is expressing any thanks to Israel and the United States for this. They are completely counterproductive in what they're doing.
No one's expressing any thanks, but are people daring to hope? I take the point fully that people want to be masters of their own destiny and they want to have self-determination and they don't want to have regime change violently thrust upon them. Israel is saying, we're doing this to stop Iran's nuclear program. We're doing this because Iran has been funding Hamas and Hezbollah. Maybe the people will rise up and there'll be a regime change. Trump is going a bit more heavy into complete surrender. It's time for regime change. Are those thoughts laughed at as like a fantasy? Because you seem to be presenting as a fait accompli, this will make things worse. There is no way that this is going to make things better. Do people dare to hope? Well, this may not be the way that we want regime change, but this is the opportunity, and history doesn't always follow your favorite choice for how things happen. You take the opportunity where you can.
Look, I mean, it's impossible to generalize. Of course, some people are hoping for that. I think they're pretty ignorant. I think anyone who's studied the situation knows that in the event of regime change, it's going to be disastrous, and not just for Iran, but for the entire region, or Israel, or the United States. You just have to look at the track record here, okay? The United States sought regime change in Afghanistan. It got mired in a war. It fought it uselessly. It did not even achieve its aim of catching bin Laden in Afghanistan. It fought against the Taliban for years and ultimately gave up, went home. The Taliban resumed their power over Afghanistan. What about Iraq? Similar story. The United States decides regime change is necessary because of a fake claim of weapons of mass destruction. That is found to be fake, but the U.S. spills enormous amounts of blood. ISIS gains hold in the region. Nothing good came of that war either, and Iraq is still a weak state. What about Libya? Similar story again. Eliminating Gaddafi has left a vacuum in which militias, terrorist ones, have projected power across all of North and West Africa. This doesn't work. If you try the same thing three times in 25 years and it screws up every single time, you have to be lunatic to think it's going to work in Iran. Seriously, lunatic. And so those of us who, I think, understand the history of U.S. intervention, egged on by Israel, you recall Israel was very much egging on the invasion of Iraq. Israel at the time was saying, while you're at it, do Iran. They have the capacity to build a bomb imminently. They said that in 2003. We're 20 years later. They still haven't built a bomb. These false pretenses justifying quote-unquote regime change against international law have never worked out well. And they're not going to work well this time.
The narrative that is coming through a lot of media commentary on this is different. This is being hailed as an incredible act of military precision and bravado, a spectacular military operation by Israel, and one that the world should be thanking Israel for, because the hundreds of casualties that we're seeing now compared to what might occur had Iran been allowed to continue to build its nuclear program and if it had reached capacity as a nuclear power. And it is true that Iranian officials and the president and Ayatollahs have been threatening to wipe Israel off the map and to destroy Israel for decades. The story that is being projected out there is that this is an incredible gift to humanity, that we are avoiding that outcome. I am going to assume that you are somewhat skeptical of that argument.
I mean, a few reactions to that. First of all, sure, Iran has been saying that garbage for years, right? We're going to destroy Israel. Israel has been saying the garbage for years that Iran is imminently to have a bomb. You can't trust either of these mendacious countries. You can't. I mean, they're both lying. The U.S. too. I mean, principally, the gall that the U.S. had to lie to its closest allies in 2003 to enter a war in Iraq, saying weapons of mass destruction were there. Or how efficiently the targeting of Israel was done. Israel has a very sophisticated military. It can target. It has the best technology in the world, thanks to the United States. It uses that fine targeting technology not to best effect. It uses it indiscriminately. And in Gaza, the entire place is leveled with precision bombs. That's the irony, right? The whole place leveled with the most precise bombs that only attack the things you want to attack. So in Iran, I wouldn't say it's been as finely targeted as those who you were summarizing would put it. I mean, just yesterday, Israel hit the main police building in Tehran. Now, the police aren't military, okay? Sure, they play a nasty role in an authoritarian state, no doubt. But if you take out the police and then you take out the regime, could you be doing more to bring about chaos? Israel is targeting the police because it is trying to sow chaos. Chaos in Iran is not going to be in anyone's interest. That's not precise targeting.
Since October 7th, there has been an Iranian-Canadian presence in support of Israel. I am wondering, and I brought up that counter-narrative to ask you, is anybody happy about this? Is anybody hopeful because of this?
I think those that are foolishly so. Yeah, of course there are. I mean, there's a lot of Iranian-Canadians. I mean, you will find among them examples of every opinion, right? The big biodiverse community of ideas that those people hold. But what I'm trying to impress on you is, for those who think rationally about it, no good can come of this. And I think also, to take it one step further, Jesse, for those who think rationally about it, the premise for a preemptive war, I suppose that's what Israel is characterizing it as, is A, illegal, and B, not ethical. I mean, look at the very premise of this. Israel has to destroy Iran before it gets nuclear weapons. Israel itself has nuclear weapons. It's had them since the 1960s. That's when its program got underway. The U.S. is the only country in the world to have used nuclear weapons. We have two nuclear weapon countries saying that they have the right to prevent another country acquiring exactly what they've got. I mean, this is the hypocrisy of the highest order.
I know why that doesn't matter to them, right? The notion that they should allow a country that has sworn to annihilate them to also acquire nuclear weapons because that would be fair is not one that's going to carry much water.
I think the appropriate outcome here, Jesse, is Israel gives up its nuclear weapons and Iran does. You can't have a situation where Israel is pointing a nuclear arsenal at Iran saying, don't you dare do the same to us. And that is exactly the reality of it. And yet, Mark Carney, the G7, falls in line with Israel's narrative about their right to defense. The G7 communique, you know, that mentioned Israel's right to defense, but not Iran's. That's a problem. What we should be aware of is that our prime minister just f***ed this up royally at the G7.
Let's talk about the G7. Here's what they just said. And this is Canada and the other G7 nations. We, the leaders of the G7, reiterate our commitment to peace and stability in the Middle East. In this context, we affirm that Israel has a right to defend itself. We reiterate our support for the security of Israel. We also affirm the importance of the protection of civilians. Iran is the principal source of regional instability and terror. We have been consistently clear that Iran can never have a nuclear weapon. That's to read from that statement. So it seems like the narrative that I just described is one that the G7 is like fully invested in.
They are. And I think it's insanity. I mean, it's not even correct. Iran has not gone to war except through proxies who do have some agency of their own. It's made to appear they don't. We have just seen Mark Carney propagate alive such an extent that my support for him is out the window. My honeymoon period is already over. No, Iran is not the principal threat. It's Israel right now. They're not done yet. What we are failing to see as Westerners is that Israel's on a bender here. It's damaging its relations and its neighbors severely. That indicates it's lost its calm judgment since October 7th. And now it's about to do the same to Iran. Actually started, I suppose. And that will have no good ending. Why? Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, no good endings. This one won't have it either. Second of all, the available evidence, including from the Director of National Intelligence in the U.S., is that Iran is years from a bomb. Third of all, that containment and rapprochement with Iran has been working. The Saudis showed us that. They have really brought down their tensions with Iran. If diplomacy is working, you do not press the launch button on a war. And that is something that Israel blew. Israel should be called out for that. It should not be said, as Mr. Carney did, that Iran is the principal source of instability right now. That's Israel. These realities were lost in the G7. They were lost because of our prime minister. I don't know what political calculation he's making, but what he is doing is he is paving the road to war. We are in for decades, not years, decades, could be a century of real trouble in the entire region, because Iran is a far more significant country by numbers, by history, by technology, than Afghanistan, Libya, or Iraq ever were. This is the moment at which that set of mistakes is about to be repeated in a vastly more inflammable crucible.
Thanks, Amir. All right, after the break, we're going to be speaking with somebody with a very different perspective on what's going on.
My name is Kaveh Shirouz. I'm an Iranian-Canadian. I'm a lawyer, a human rights activist, and a senior fellow with the McDonald Laurier Institute.
Hi, Kaveh.
Hi, good to be with you, Jesse.
Before we get into it, how are you doing in terms of checking in on family? How's your family doing? Do you have people that you have that you're worried about in Iran?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking. It's a tough time. It's a tough time for me and everybody that's everybody obviously that's in the country, but those of us that are outside are worried, sick. I have a lot of family back in Iran, and unfortunately, the last time I was able to talk to them was about 48 hours ago. That's when the regime cut off the internet, so it's hard to access anybody now. My family is mostly concentrated in Tehran. Some of them have managed to leave and go to the north where they think it's a little bit safer. Some members of my family are elderly. One is hospitalized, so they're kind of just trapped in Tehran, and they're waiting for the bombs to fall. So hopefully they will be safe.
And there has been, from Israel, advice, I guess, to evacuate a city of 10 million people. Kind of an impossibility for 10 million people to evacuate.
Yeah, regrettably, it seems like these pieces of advice, or whatever you want to call them, they're more kind of cover-your-ass statements than actually a desire to get civilians out, because it's impractical what they're asking people to do.
I know that no one person can represent any one community, but I think it's possible for us to try to understand the different points of view. And my understanding, based on our last conversation and based on just living a life in Toronto amongst Persians, is that there's almost universal opposition to the regime. And that's why Iranian people are in Canada for the most part. But it's more complicated than that, isn't it?
It certainly is. And when it comes to the war, things get all tangled up. So, yeah, I think in the circles in which we move, you and I, you will find an almost universal hatred of this regime. There are pockets of support for the regime. You might find it in the local Shiite mosques or whatever in Toronto, places I don't frequent, but I know they exist. But when it comes to the war, I think the views are more complicated. There are those who, in certain pockets that I referenced, oppose war because they just want this regime to stay in power, and they want it to be powerful. So that's one group. But even among those who oppose the regime, there are different points of view. Some want the war to continue to the point where this regime falls. And then there are others who want the war to stop because, A, they think perhaps Israeli intention in this case is not good, but more importantly, they're concerned that inevitably there will be mass casualties. And they've seen, you know, what's happened to Gaza in the past, you know, couple of years, and they don't want any city in Tehran to turn into Gaza.
Is there a concept that a war that is fought like this, that is so far, and these are very early moments, the casualties have been limited, and Israel is being praised by some for the surgical precision and for targeting the chain of command and the nuclear facilities, though there have been civilian casualties, absolutely. Is there a hope that this could prevent some kind of a ground war? This could prevent some kind of a, what everybody's been watching in Gaza, destruction block by block. Better to get it over with. Is there hope for that?
Yeah, that sentiment definitely exists. In fact, I would put myself in that camp. So far, I've been watching what the IDF has done, and I don't want to obviously write anybody a blank check, but if Israel continues to do what it has been doing, I don't see much of a problem with it. I mean, their attacks have been fairly targeted. Regrettably, there will be civilian casualties. You know, when you blow up a condo unit in which some bigwig of the Iranian regime lives, there are bound to be neighbors or whatever that get hurt, and that's an incredible tragedy, but that's just the reality of modern warfare. I remain hopeful that these kinds of attacks will degrade the Iranian regime's capabilities such that they will eventually have to surrender, and hopefully that will lead to a fairly quick change in regime.
I heard a very different point of view, which won't surprise you, from Amir Adaran, and his point of view was that no good could come of this, and that Iran was already moving towards a self-correction, that the regime was becoming more liberal and tolerant, that the country was becoming more free, that they're not the same crackdowns on women for how they dress, and that an internal self-guided move towards more civil liberties and freedom was always going to be a better path than some violently imposed change to government. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that point of view.
I mean, I think if you were to talk to Amir Attaran 3 years ago, he would have said the same. 5 years ago, he would have said the same. 20 years ago, he would have said the same. There is a contingent of Iran watchers who have been singing the same tune since the late 90s when a so-called reform movement took place. And every time we're told to keep waiting because better times are ahead, you know, things are liberalizing, things are opening up, but it never actually does. Maybe there will be moments, months at a time, where enforcement of the hijab is reduced, or, you know, space opens up a little bit for journalists to write some articles. But then immediately after, within 6 months, there's a crackdown and things go back to the way they were. There is something about the DNA of this very regime that's unreformable. It does not liberalize. It needs to go. And I think, you know, with the exception of a few progressives like Dr. Attaran here in the West and a handful of people back in Iran, nobody believes this reform talk anymore. I think people have moved on. You've heard it in the slogans that people chant when they come out in the streets. They did, you know, a couple of years ago with the Woman Life Freedom Movement. One of the key chants was, you know, reformists and hardliners, you know, your time's up. Basically, the rejection of, you know, this game of these two different factions of the same regime. And you see it in the articles they publish and so on. The people of Iran have moved on. I would recommend that Dr. Attaran do the same.
What about the people of Canada, the Iranian-Canadian people? It's just really hard to get a handle on what the consensus is or what the camps are, because there have been some very vocal members of the Iranian-Canadian community in the Free Palestine movement, very, very vocal and outspoken critics of Israel. And then there are also Iranians who have been a constant presence in rallies that have been for bringing the hostages home, rallies that are solidarity with Israeli people, if not the Israeli government. So there is the public presentation and the loudest voices have been diametrically opposed in terms of support or condemnation of Israel. I don't know what to infer from that about where the mainstream is at, or, you know, household to household.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a large community and there are a lot of different views, but there is a reason why you see the same five Iranian people at the Palestinian protests and the same five people showing up at all the hard right Israeli protests. That's because they're minority voices. I think the vast majority of the members of our community are somewhere in the middle. My feeling, based on a lot of conversations, is that on average, there is more sympathy for Israel among the Iranian community than you would find among any other Middle Eastern group. We share a common enemy in the Islamic regime in Tehran. I think people are aghast at kind of what they've seen happen in Gaza. I don't think anyone's in favor of that. But the sympathy still lies, I would say, by and large, with Israel. My sense is it's the same with this war. I think in talking to members of my community, but also in talking to, you know, when I had the opportunity to talk to members of my family and friends back in Iran before the internet was shut off, there is a lot of anger, but most of the anger about this war is directed at the regime itself and not at Israel.
I imagine you're going to get pushback from people around the idea that there is widespread sympathy for Israel. But I think that the operative question is not so much how many Iranian Canadians support Israel, because I'm not sure how much it matters how much any Canadians support or abhor Israel. I guess I'm more curious about what degree of hope is interwoven with the anxiety and fear and concern for family. If the dreams of the diaspora is for this regime to fall, this might not be the best way for it to happen. But is there a hope that the silver lining is, even for those who are virulently opposed to Israel, is there, well, we'll take it if this is the opportunity, then there is a way that this could shake out for the better.
Those that are fundamentally opposed to Israel probably don't think along these lines. But for the others, I would say there are several possibilities, several possible outcomes from this war. And one of them, and I don't know how likely it is, all these different outcomes, what the probability of each one is, but one possible outcome is for this regime to fall because of a popular uprising that comes as a result of it, and that a democracy of some kind, a secular democracy, takes shape. So I know that a fair number of people still maintain that hope, but there are other outcomes that are very bleak. And, you know, a coup d'etat that sort of maintains this regime just in a slightly different form, or a civil war, I mean, those would be disastrous outcomes, and they're not unlikely. Again, I don't know the percentage likelihood, but they're not unlikely outcomes. But there is a sliver of hope.
What do you think? Because I've heard it argued that how after Iraq and Afghanistan, how could we think that a violently imposed change to government, it hasn't gone so well in that region in the past. So why would we imagine it would go any better this time?
Well, it might go better because Iran in 2025 is not Afghanistan in 2001 or Iraq in 2003 or whatever it was that the attack occurred. Iran has a long, long history of its citizens yearning for democracy and struggling for democracy. Iran had a constitutional revolution as far back as 1906, and it actually was successful for a brief while, and then problems arose and dictatorship took hold again. And then there was, again, movement towards democracy in 1979. There was hope for democracy, at least. It didn't materialize. This was always sort of in the air. And then in the last few years, you know, we've seen uprising after uprising in Iran, people wanting democracy.